Tonight on Arena, on TV, Ironheart Countdown and Attack on London hunting the 77 bombers, and in albums, Kesha, K Tempest and Lorde, all of them up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet us at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. TV reviews as usual to start on a Friday evening, when a Homeland Security officer is murdered in broad daylight. An LAPD officer is recruited by a secret task force of undercover agents from all branches of law enforcement to investigate. That's the premise for Countdown, a new crime thriller from Prime Video. Stars Jensen Ackles, Eric Dane and Jessica Camacho. Netflix marks the 20th anniversary of the London bombings with a documentary series, Attack on London, Hunting the 77 Bombers. It revisits the tragic day when four suicide bombers struck London's transport system, killing 52 people and injuring hundreds. We hear survivors and investigators' accounts as they reflect on the attack and the manhunt that followed. And Ironheart is Marvel's latest Disney miniseries. It follows Riri Williams, a 19-year-old tech genius, first introduced to us in Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. After returning home to Chicago from MIT, Riri begins building an advanced suit of armour inspired by Iron Man, but soon crosses paths with all kinds of dangerous criminals and is looking for a bit of money to be invested into her invention as well. As usual, Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon are with me in studio. And let's just start with the big Disney one there. Latest in the ever-expanding Marvel Universe. Do you know, I could take that phrase, in the ever-expanding Marvel Universe, and if they wanted to use it AI, they'd probably get about five programs out of it. I don't know how often I say it. Ironheart, Chris, I believe, is a nod to Black Panther and Iron Man. They nod to all their own stuff. Not this Marvel Universe.
Yeah, you would want to have watched the two Black Panther films, but especially Black Panther Wakanda Forever, when Riri Williams, the main character here, is introduced, played by Dominic Thorne. And also, maybe go back and rewatch Iron Man from 17 years ago, because there are
characters
here.
That would be a bit
of fun. It might be a bit of fun, but at this point, like, the Marvel homework is really beginning to pile up. and there's a problem at the beginning of this series where you kind of feel a little bit lost, because we first met this character 3 years ago, but three years in Marvel and also in film and television circles, that's quite a long time. So the show at first is kind of stumbling to reintroduce everyone, to re-establish Riri's backstory. But I suppose it eventually finds its rhythm. It is straightforward enough. She's an MIT student. She's on this Tony Stark fellowship, Stark being the billionaire superhero Iron Man. She figured out in Black Panther Wakanda Forever how to build her own iron suit. Here, all these years later, you think she's hung around with superheroes. You know, she's got Tony. She used to have Tony Stark as a mentor. Things should be going well. It's not, because, you know, she's young. She's a young black woman from a poor neighborhood. She doesn't have Tony Stark like money, and she realizes that to be successful in the superhero business and in this tech business, you need to have funds.
Yeah, well, not only in the super tech, the superhero business, you need it for life, as she is finding out, I suppose, as well. And here is Dominic Thorne plays this character of Riri Williams, and called into the office of MIT by the dean, played here by Tanya Freeman. The news is not good.
All that considered, I thought maybe you could convince the board to extend my grant just one more year. If I could just get my idea off the ground, help would never be too late. This could change the world.
Sorry.
Riri, I understand why this project is a passion of yours, but you've been here over 4 years, with as many disciplinary hearings on record, and still no true matriculation towards a degree.
Due respect, Dean Choi, what do I get out of matriculation? Some job in Palo Alto with a tiny window and a bunch of guys I have to pretend to like? I want to build something undeniable. I want real-life scientific epiphanies. You want me to do homework? I have to explain to my professors. You want me to be small. But I refuse.
Riri, that's a hot pile of garbage. Trash, and you know it. Who here asked you to be small? It's not a rhetorical question.
You didn't ask her to be small, but you said you're off the course if you don't get the grant. Riri Thorne there, played by Dominic. Williams, played by Dominic Thorne. And then we heard the dean, played by Tanya Freeman there. not very sympathetic. I must have to say, as I listened to Riri Williams there, I was on her side. I want her to be given the grant for the year.
Oh, God, yeah, you are on her side. And I think, you know, that Dominic Thorne is a good presence, on-screen presence. She has that cockiness of youth that you can hear. And when she is on the screen, you are rooting for her. You do want her to succeed in her harebrained schemes. And you want her to see things through. Because as Chris was saying, you know, she's so different from your Tony Stark. Yeah. She is this young girl who has these dreams. And a young black girl from Chicago who wants to make her imprint on the world.
Have you any idea of the size of the three-letter butt that is hanging over your shoulder at the moment? Because I can hear a very big butt coming.
This would be a prime opportunity, I think, for showrunner Chinaka Hodge to interrogate the time that we find ourselves in. And, you know, we are at the whim of these oligarchs and these tech bros. And why is it exactly that she is forced to struggle? Why is it? What is happening in the world that is making this so hard for her to succeed in her dreams and being forced to sell, you know, to make ends meet? You see her where she's selling completed assignments to other students across the state, and that's why she's being expelled, and that's why she's being sent home to Chicago. And, you know, she is there. It's about the it should be about the uneven power dynamics of this era, but that she dismisses this. She blithely dismisses it in the first few seconds of the show.
Well, even the way the dean speaks there is kind of, is that really what the dean is going to say to a young woman in that situation?
Tony Stark is her hero, but she dismisses, you know, the world that he is a part of. Right. And she just says, oh, no shade, that's the way the world works. And I mean, that's fine, I guess, but I found it to be very fearful writing. Like, it's writing that is caught in the cog of a mega franchise. And perhaps she wants to say something deeper about wealth in America, but they're not confronting it deeply enough with this show, unfortunately.
Now, we have the sense of who Riri is in this, but she kind of gets involved with a I don't know how you would describe them, a group of people, Parker Robbins, played by Anthony Ramos, and a bundle of
thieves.
Are they ne'er-do? Oh, no, they
thieves,
are.
Yeah.
Are they ne'er-do-wells? They're thieves.
Yeah, I don't really understand their logic.
Are they good thieves? Are they Robin Hoodie type of thieves?
They're cool thieves. They're very cool and handsome, and they seem to have it all together. They're not very convincing as criminals.
Why,
and
should thieves be ugly?
No, not at all, no. But I just didn't for a second believe that these guys kind of, you know, had a working plan between them. They're just, it's an odd idea that they're stealing from billionaires. They're essentially breaking into these, you know, huge businesses with a little magic. Anthony Ramos is playing a character named Parker Robbins, but he's also the Hood. He's got this peculiar Doctor Strange-like hood. He's got some dark magic hanging over him. It's not important. He's just very powerful, basically. But they're stealing from the rich to give back to themselves.
Oh, and Riri isn't going to gain and be able to follow through her project with this money.
Riri has a problem with that. I mean, Riri is enlisted after the Hood realizes what kind of power she has, that she's in possession of an Iron Man suit. I found all that stuff just a little bit strange. We were kind of talking about this beforehand. This sometimes feels like two or three different shows competing against one another, and every time it comes up against a really good idea, it runs away from it, because there's this fascinating scene in the second episode that's kind of a half a throwback to the original Iron Man, but also a sign of how this show could be. And in Iron Man, in the first Iron Man, or maybe even the second one, when Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man comes across authorities, they go to shoot at him, and then they realize, oh, he's very powerful and we shouldn't be doing this. In this, Riri's helmet is off so they can see that it's a young black woman, and they still hold their weapons up to her, and she can't convince them to throw it away. And she's frightened and she's scared, and you think, this is something interesting here.
Yeah, because that sounds like the series that Jen is looking for. You know, let's interrogate the idea. Why should a young black woman have the guns pointed at her in a way that perhaps somebody with an iron hood or a young white person wouldn't have that gun pointed at them?
And there is, but it just doesn't go far enough. And there is this emotional resonance to it, because when Riri heads home to Chicago, she's dealing with the ghosts of her recent past, the death of her stepfather and her best friend Natalie, and they loom over this constantly. And those are the most touching and involved that we get with this character. But the magical, the superhero narrative knitted into that, it's wobbly, it's shaky, it's not great. It
sounds like a missed opportunity for something that could have been really, really good. Stars overall, Jen?
I think that, you know, with Marvel, anything dynamic, the Marvel fan base don't want it. They don't want this story that we're saying that we want. Mm. They want their superheroes to fulfill a certain criteria, and unfortunately, any writers who get involved in that megalith structure of Marvel, they will suffer under the weight of the ridiculous expectation of that fan base.
Yeah, because they're very active online. The Marvel
they've poo-pooed this completely. So I think we need to free our superheroes from banality and Ironheart bends to the will of Marvel, unfortunately. Yeah. So 2.5.
And what are you saying, Chris?
I'm still waiting for Marvel to rediscover their groove because they had it at one point. But I do like everyone involved here. Dominic Thorne, I think Lyric Ross puts in a lovely performance too, because Ironheart,
Lyric Ross
is playing this character, Natalie. And Ironheart.
Oh, this is an AI type of character.
Yeah. But it's a shadow of Riri's late friend who was killed from a gunshot wound. Yeah. And all of that stuff, you know,
very powerful too.
Very powerful, yeah. And I thought Lyric Ross and Dominic worked very well together. So lovely performances, nice ideas. I'm rooting for it, but it's a cautious 3 stars.
A cautious 3 stars. Okay, let us move on then to Can't help it. Countdown.
I mean, I wish I was watching Countdown. I would watch 7,000 episodes of Countdown compared to this.
Well, that says a lot about you, Jen, perhaps. Prime Video have a series called Countdown, that should have the theme music from the quiz show, clearly. No big clocks. Well, there must be a clock happening here, but a crime thriller is what we're talking about. A maverick LAPD detective recruited to a secret task force. Oh, Lord. Listen. This is a bit like the ever-expanding cinematic universe. You know, it sounds like another big cliche.
This is AI television. This is ChatGPT television. We have reached this. I mean, because like the past 5 years of the screener boom, I think have devolved into will this do kind of attitude because of the proliferation of companies that are out there and the supposed demand of the audience who are consuming more entertainment than ever. And it's a recipe for the mediocre and the downright unwatchable, and this is part of that. And I can't help but think it's the kind of show that Prime doesn't even want you to watch, or Prime doesn't even think you'll find it. When you're stumbling through tonight looking through what show you're going to watch, they want you to skip over this. I mean, it's such a non-show. It feels like it doesn't exist. It's a fever dream, a patchwork of cliches, like you're just saying, a task force, like from other more successful crime, you know, series. And Jensen Ackles, like, he plays this Mark Meacham, this LAPD detective who is recruited to this secret task force. And, you know, the man is a renegade, everyone. Oh, my God. And, like, he can't be tamed. So it's all sarcastic retorts. Yeah. It's all painful, cool guy expressions. And he has this tough demeanor. But what lies inside of him? Yeah. Is it a sensitive heart? Shocker.
Apart from all of that, Jen, is it any good?
It's great.
Yeah, I can hear. Yeah, I've never heard you quite so angry about something.
I just think, you know, I mean, the task force is supposed to be assembled because really it's about they don't care who lives or dies in this task force because they're all so out there. And that is that a hook? Are we supposed to care about them then? Okay. I don't know.
let's have a listen to a clip then and see if the acting will save the fairly cliched setup. Mark Meacham, is that how I say his name?
Yes.
Played by Jensen Ackles here, is an undercover cop in this maximum security prison. He's getting treated following an attack when an LAPD sergeant, Hugh Lambert, visits him, and Christian Barber is the actor there. The acting here, let's just hope there are no acting police listening at the moment, that sirens will be flying out the road.
A minute, please.
Thank you, Tony.
A riot?
No, it wasn't a riot. It was a fight. They jumped me. I defended myself.
The warden said riot?
Yeah, well, the warden's been up my ass since I went UC, okay? He's a complete... Let me worry about the warden. Listen, I got Albert Chung this close to telling me everything.
Doesn't matter. I'm pulling you.
You what?
You're getting pulled.
No. Come on, Sarge. I've been in this shithole for 9 months, and I'm this close to getting everything that I need.
Whatever you've got has got to work because you're out of here. You've been assigned to a federal task force. What's wrong with your head?
Nothing. I mean, I took a few shots, but, wait, did you say I have to report to a task force?
Get your ass cleaned up. Get back to LA.
Okay, but it wasn't a riot. I'll make that clear.
Did it. If they put in the Countdown jingle,
put in Carol Vorderman, it might be better.
Yeah. Ooh, that is quite. I mean, that is the acting leaves something to be desired, shall we say? But the script there is so awful.
Yeah, we were laughing there because
all the wrong reasons.
Well, the main character Mark, he's talking to nobody there at the end, so he's talking to a closed door, which is quite strange. And you wouldn't really get a sense of what the show is really about from that clip, because the task force is not to investigate the murder of a Department of Homeland Security officer. It's really to try and stop a nuclear attack on Los Angeles, which is just bananas. And the show actually runs out of ways to say how big this nuclear attack could be, because you have the special agent Nathan Blythe, played by Eric Dane, numerous times nuclear attack, once you say that should be serious.
Yeah.
But he keeps hammering home, he keeps saying a Hiroshima size attack, and then later on a Chernobyl size attack. It's like, we get it, we know what's at stake here. And the thing is, Sean, this could have been brilliant, because it started off very well, at least for me, because the first person you see in the show is Milo Ventimiglia, who I really like from This Is Us, from Gilmore Girls. A decent, solid actor, a charismatic presence, and he's killed off straight away. It's a very starry cameo that maybe does two things. That one,
does he come back? No.
This is in a very opening scene.
No flashbacks or anything.
No. Okay. It's a starry cameo. I think it's sort of like a Drew Barrymore in Scream type situation, to let you know that everyone's expendable here, that, you know, anything could happen at any minute. But also, I think maybe Milo Ventimiglia knows one of the people involved in the show. He was just doing the favor. He should have been the main character.
Definitely.
I would have watched him.
He wouldn't have asked the door. Task force.
No. But like, the thing
did is, I hear task force.
I mean, the comfort of cliche is fine. Something like Reacher on Prime as well, that works really well because it's very self-aware. It's funny, it's silly.
Yeah.
It never outstays its welcome. This is treated as it's purely serious. Mm. And
13 episodes of it as well.
13 episodes, which is incredible. And I can spoiler this. I don't think anybody's going to reach the end of the 13, but there's a time jump that happens and then it renders everything previous maybe to be nonsensical.
So the whole show is nonsensical. Bobby comes out of the shower.
Exactly.
At some point along the way.
All right. I'm getting the sense that you have not had a good week at the TV screens. What are you saying overall about a countdown? I should be asking you how many vowels or how many consonants perhaps instead.
I would totally forgive the boneheaded setup if it was fun, but it's really not. And
because if they took the pee out of themselves, that would be great stuff to watch.
Oh, two extra stars at least. Yeah. And also, like the soundtrack, every time it runs out of things to say, and it does actually run out of things to say sometimes. Here's some Raconteurs, here's some Metallica, here's some Art the Monkeys. It's like, we get it, and they're all macho, manly songs to go with Mark Meacham, because he's just, you know, the greatest cop in the world. Yeah. It's terrible. It really is. You've said there it's 13 episodes. It's 13 episodes too long, basically. Two stars.
Two stars.
It's the televisual equivalent of a ghost kitchen. It's ridiculous.
A ghost kitchen?
Yes. I mean,
a ghost kitchen now?
When you order food, but it's not actually from the restaurant. It's just from this place where people make the food in some outlet. I mean, they could all head off on a spaceship or reveal themselves to be lizards, and I doubt the vast majority of people will end up watching to the very end. I mean, I wouldn't mind a lizard cop travel time travel scenario.
That'd
but
be great.
Anything but this derivative slop. It's a one.
I was surprised it even got a one after all of that. That's Countdown on Prime Video, perhaps not being recommended for your viewing tonight or for the next 13 Fridays if you chose to do that. Let's move on then to our final series this evening on Netflix, Attack on London, Hunting the 77 Bombers, 2025, obviously marking the 20th anniversary of the devastating terrorist attack, 7th of July. The actual day of the anniversary is coming to us fairly soon, obviously. Four suicide bombers set off explosives in underground stations and on a bus, killing 52 people, injuring more than 770. We've had a couple of features, both dramas and documentaries in recent months. But what kind of angle are we getting on this one, Chris?
It's kind of a catch-all documentary. It's as though the team at Netflix are like, okay, it's been 20 years, let's tell the complete story here. And at first it starts off, I thought at first this is going to be the survivors' tales, because there's an awful lot of stories here. You think we were glued to this 20 years ago and you think you know all of the details inside out. But at the beginning, the idea of speaking to people like Dan Biddle, one of the people who was on the tube, he recalls in...
Well, actually, I have him, yep. I have a clip of Dan Biddle. Let him tell his story in his own words. There's quite a bit of language in the midst of all of this, but you can perhaps understand as he describes in graphic detail, I should warn you as well, some of what he had to look at and some of what he experienced. You can forgive him the odd expletive in the middle of all of that.
The tunnel was completely silent. One minute I was stood on the train, The next minute I'm on the tracks. In my head I was like, what the fuck am I doing out here? Very thick, heavy, like dust and dirt was in the air, hitting your teeth and hitting your tongue. And then you'd hear one voice and then another and then another. I'd never heard screams like this. I tried to sit up and I couldn't. And I could see something sticking up from kind of right in front of me. The pole that I'd been leaning against had sheared off and gone through me. And I had something digging in my back. I managed to grab it and pull it out. And it was part of someone's lower leg and their foot, and it still had the shoe and the sock on it. So now I'm holding this thing, looking at it, thinking, fuck, I'm in a bad, bad situation.
He certainly was in a bad situation. Dan Biddle there in a clip from Attack in London, Hunting the 7/7 Bombers, Netflix series about those bombs in London on the 7th of July, 20 years ago. As Chris was saying, Jen, when you hear Dan Biddle giving that evidence, and there's another young Muslim man who yeah. gives evidence, or not evidence, who tells what happened to them.
Yeah.
You know, there was a side of me that thought, you can never hear that too often. It's really important that these stories are told.
It's like the way we feel about when there's really good 9/11 documentaries, because those testimonies are so powerful, they're so strong. You need to hear what people went through on that day. Mm. And I think the documentary is most effective when you hear somebody like Dan Biddle talk, but also the ordinary British Muslim people and the devastating consequences that these attacks had on their lives. You have someone like Mustafa, I think it's Kurtul.
Yeah, Kurtaldu, yeah.
And he is like still suffering from the trauma of the attack when he finds himself on, you know, breakfast morning television being quizzed and about his faith by Kate Garraway, and as if he is this spokesperson for, you know, his faith, which is really upsetting. And I think that strand is very interesting about the Islamophobia that was increased, obviously, around the time of the attacks and how ordinary Muslim people dealt with it. And that's shocking and needs to be seen and needs to be told.
You can hear exactly the same thing that happened to ordinary Irish people during the IRA bombing campaign in London. But you could also, if the TV presenter hadn't asked those questions, she'd have been absolutely lambasted for asking them. But to ask them off him was so unfair.
So unfair, and it's extraordinary, because this was either the next day or the
following
day
morning,
after.
I think. Yeah, a couple of days.
Yeah,
within a couple
within
of days.
48 hours. And at that point, there were no leads. And there was no idea, like nobody had any idea who did this. So to raise those questions and to ask him this on live television and putting on the spot, it's horrible. And you can see that it's, like as Jen was saying, like that it still has an effect on him.
Yeah.
I think if you were to build a documentary around survivor stories like Dan's, like Mustafa's, there's another one in there, a woman talks about losing her mother when she was 16. Another woman has this extraordinary story about how she got on the bus because one of the explosions was on the bus. She got on a bus, she got a text from her partner to say, you know, there's panic underground, something's happened. And she says, everything's all right. And then moments later, the bus exploded. Yes. Stories like that, in a single documentary would be great, but it's almost as if the documentary makers are saying, we have to do everything here. We have
because I watched the first episode and I thought it was really powerful because it concentrated on those stories of those survivors and the horrific injuries that many of them suffered at the time. And we see the evidence, we see the physical evidence of those horrific injuries as well. Then it goes off into the investigators and, you know, the plot up in Luton and Leeds and how there was. And I thought, I've seen all of this before too many times, and particularly in recent months. And yes, while it was interesting, it was the story of the survivors that I wanted to hear.
Yeah, it can't help itself as well. And it loses its way with these tacky reconstructions, with this ominous, overbearing score. You've got numerous shots of London on its side as if to kind of depict like a city turned upside down by this. It's just, it's very heavy-handed. And, you know, you should handle these things with a little bit of subtlety. And I think it loses its way entirely when it starts speaking to the officers who shot and killed John Charles de Menezes, who we were actually only just talking about.
Because we had the dramatization.
Which was really brilliant.
Astonishing stuff and brilliantly done.
I would urge people to definitely watch Suspect. Yes. I think it's one of the shows of the year for sure. But I do agree with Chris. I found it to be a exploitative when it comes to talking to this group, who carried out this operation. There's no need for it to be over dramatized, to have those reconstructions, to make it as bombastic as possible. I just thought it was quite distasteful, especially when they interview one of the actual main shooter and he's in a locker room and he has a hood over his head because he doesn't want to be identified. It felt like you were watching a video game and not real life. And I think anything that takes you out of the reality of the situation, of the effects of this, like those powerful testimonies that were so real, when it takes you out of that, it's disappointing and it feels unreal. And then we have Tony Blair, who is, you know, they interview Tony Blair and it's just such a moot point. It goes nowhere because he's so slick that they never get under the surface with him.
It was better to see him in situ,
in real life, in the footage when it actually happened.
The blood had drained from his face. He didn't know what to say.
Completely.
And obviously, now he was a lot more measured.
Really prepared. And I think, like, not having Cressida Dick, obviously, is a huge issue as well, because she just won't talk about the failures around this. Yeah. And I think that's very important.
And the George Charles de Menza is saying, you have to remember, he essentially was a victim of this bombing as well, in a different way. Mm-hmm. He died because of what had happened.
Yeah.
That's
and
how
I know
his death happened.
That the filmmaker, really, Liza Williams, like, she does want to speak to people around the operation, she said, because she wants to open up what exactly happened and the mistakes that were made. But I think the focus is all wrong in those episodes.
Yeah, it felt the
tone was strange.
One officer who kept saying, we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know what we were doing. You know, and I did. It was good to see those type of admissions being made. We had no idea what was happening.
Yeah, but then to kind of blend in reconstructions of what happened, it's just there's no real taste there. I think it loses the tact. And also the editing. I mean, there's some really thoughtful, meaningful testimonials here, but it's all chopped up so that it's just basically...
And the score.
Score. So it's basically just half an hour of sound bites. And it just, I think the victims and the people telling their stories here, they deserve better than that.
Yeah, because even as we were listening to Dan Biddle's there's this big ominous music underneath. Mm. Yeah.
We don't need it. It's not necessary.
What he's telling us is already horrific enough. Mm. You don't need to highlight that. However, it was good to hear those new testimonies. And for that, does that merit enough for watching it and Stars overall?
Yeah.
It's not a bad taste to be talking about Stars about something like this.
I just think that,
Jen,
you know, it follows the usual trajectory of these Netflix documentaries, which I found disappointing. And I think if it had been a little more respectful, less dramatic in some ways, I feel 4 episodes is enough to tell the story to tell the story fully.
And this is 6, is it?
Four. So I admire that it does end on this note of frustration, but I wouldn't say it's essential viewing. There's a Sky documentary at the moment that was started last Sunday, and I think that's actually better than this. So, I mean, I'd give this a 3.
A 3. And what are you saying overall, Chris?
I think the filmmaker should have allowed the survivors to tell their stories without any gimmicks, without any special effects. Yeah. It doesn't need it at all. I think they're very brave, and I commend them for coming forward to do it. But the documentary, it tries to do too much at once, and sometimes you feel as though maybe it's trying to make a name for itself, and that did not sit right with me. So and also, you're right, it does feel a bit weird to give it a star rating, but unfortunately it's 2 stars.
Yeah, and it is quite manipulative in places, but there is a stunning image. I won't even say who the person is. Somebody's describing what has happened to them during the bombing, and then eventually, after we've heard this person speaking for maybe 6, 7, 8 minutes, the camera pulls away and we see the extent of the person's injuries, and there's nothing. You just see the picture, and the picture paints, it tells it. Yeah, better than 1,000 words. All right, that is Attack on London, Hunting the 77 Bombers on Netflix. Previously, we were talking about Ironheart streaming on Disney Plus, and Countdown available on Prime Video. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser, thank you very much. Yeah, now we go off into our album reviews. 3 artists who return with deeply personal, boundary-pushing work. American pop star Kesha returns with an album called Period, first independent release following a decade-long legal battle with a former producer. Kesha's new album is a celebration of freedom and chaos, blends genres and embraces her signature irreverence. New Zealand's Lorde offers an album called Virgin, stripped-back, emotionally charged record that explores gender, fame and vulnerability. Lorde moves away from her longtime collaborator Jack Antonoff, delivers a minimalist, introspective set that we would say
might reflect a new phase. With me in studio, Nadine O'Regan and Kane O'Sullivan. We're going to start with Kay Tempest, however. British poet and performer releases self-titled, his fifth studio album, the first since publicly transitioning, known for his powerful spoken word and socially conscious lyrics. Tempest's latest work confronts identity, trauma and resilience. Let us listen to a track from Kay Tempest, self-titled, Statue in the Square.
They can shake their heads in despair, but we've been there from the start and we ain't going nowhere. Spent my life trying to do things your way, normal didn't feel right. Trapped in a shrinking hallway till it got too tight. Deep breath, fresh air when I broke the surface.
Track called Statue in the Square from Kay Tempest's self-titled album. Nadine, you can hear it in the voice there and the identity on this album, totally different from maybe sides of Tempest that we have heard before. Mm. This is a really brave, an album that says so much about people in this transitioning situation that Tempest has been in.
Yeah, and it's not just a brave album, it's a brilliant album. I've never heard this trauma, this, like, the gender transition that has been gone through described so vividly, so articulately. And it is no surprise that it's coming from Kay Tempest, because as we were talking actually before the break, in every incarnation, Kay Tempest is the real deal. Mm. An unbelievable poet. The lyrics are so raw, so vivid, so colourful. You're brought into this world where at one level, you know, he is walking out and afraid of almost the opprobrium, the shaming that could go on in the street. And then at another level is receiving awards, being asked to speak, being asked to perform in front of thousands and thousands of people. And the disconnect is so profound, and the dysphoria that he speaks about, you know, the self-hatred, the fact of looking in a mirror and not liking what he sees. And actually there was a BBC documentary in 2023 in which he described his process of going through transitioning, having top surgery, beginning to take testosterone. And one of the immediate things about this album, if you followed him through his career, you will note the vocal is lower. Mm. The vocal has changed, and that's a bit of an immediate kind of shock for the long time listener, but it very quickly settles. And actually Kay Tempest slightly plays with that over the course of the album. It's a profound, quite amazing record.
Yeah, and the other aspect of it is Tempest has always had wonderful facility with spoken word. In fact, early manifestations really were as a poet rather than as a singer. The music kind of came along later. That aspect is still very alive in this album, but the production and the musical production seems to have notched up a few levels from previous albums.
I definitely think so. Anyway, you know, I've followed his career for a long time, and I think when he's been at his best is when he's managed to find music that suits his succinct storytelling. And I think sometimes that has let him down, but I think on this record he's really stepped it up a notch. He's produced it along with Fraser T. Smith, who is a really fantastic British producer, worked with Adele, Stormzy, Dave. And I think it's really interesting that he's chosen to lean into this male masculine record by going to hip hop. And you heard those hip hop kind of NWA, Public Enemy style beats on that track there. And I think, you know, even when he falls back on more familiar territory, when it kind of ends up in more kind of electronics, it still sounds nice. You have Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys adding a really beautiful bittersweet pop chorus on Sunshine on Catford. You have Young Fathers in there with these gorgeous harmonies. So it's a really sort of 360 production experience.
Let's have a listen to a track called Prayers to Whisper. Prayers to Whisper, and a little bit of actual singing coming in there, as opposed to almost spoken word towards the end of that track, Nadine. There is another track on the album, Know Yourself, which had been recorded earlier before transitioning happened for Tempest. And we hear that voice almost in conversation with Kay Tempest, the lower voice now. Yeah. And it's the lyrics are about the younger person speaking to the older person. I found that deeply moving.
Yeah, and I cause sometimes think back to what Annie DeFranco you say about, you know, a record is a record of an event, a time of making music, and this sense that an album should be almost like a documentary of self. And I think it's very important that this album is called self-titled, because it really is a sharing of the soul, and there's a tapestry in that particular track of a weaving together of the past and the present and a conversation, as you say, and an interplay. And it's so rich. You know, it's funny because we often review records in a way slightly for their commercial worth. You know, are they playable on radio? Will they become a hit? Will fans love them? But this record sort of goes beyond some of those considerations because it both is that. It's artistically incredibly successful. The rhythms are so striking and the cadence and the effortless wordplay. But then there's this sort of feeling that it's almost a historical document that people will look to in times to come and say, well, that's actually how it felt for this person.
Yeah, I think you'll really understand. I certainly understood things about the transitioning process that I didn't understand
that
before.
That I didn't understand before. Yeah,
and it explained things to me in a way that was very, very powerful. It starts from you on this one, Nadine.
4.5.
And from you?
Yeah, I loved it. I got totally swept up in it. I cried. I got goosebumps. 5 stars.
Yeah. It's pretty special stuff. Let's move on to Kesha. And in my innocence.
Yippee-ki-yay.
In my innocence, I did spend a little bit of time. Kind of, I was looking at the album cover going, where's the title of the album? It's a big
full stop. Yeah.
And of course, in America, that's the period. So that is where the title of the album comes from. It took me a little while to work that one out for myself. Can we find a track on Kesha that we can play? I think we can play Delusional, but I'm almost frightened to say, be careful, there's probably going to be an expletive fairly quickly. Delusional. And for any of you watching on screens, you will have seen that Nadine O'Regan and Cian Sullivan, if they had lighters, would have been...
We've been waving them like we just don't care.
And we don't allow phones in the studio because otherwise you will have the phones lit up.
Or lighters, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. However, a bit like we spoke about Kay Tempest and the journey that they have been through in recent times, Kesha hasn't been without her difficulties in recent times either,
Nadine.
I mean,
she's had such a difficult, traumatic decade, more or less, a series of lawsuits against her former producer, Dr. Luke, which was eventually resolved, settled in 2023 with, you know, allegations and counter-allegations and really indicative of, I suppose, bigger questions, of what happened to Kesha, but also the bigger question of how the industry treats women at a certain point in their career and how they can be moved around like dolls at potentially very, very, I suppose, you know, under the influence of producers who have an awful lot of power. But the thing about this record, frankly, is Kesha is literally like, she is a ball of energy. She is somebody who wants to have a great time. I was saying to your researcher in the notes, I once encountered Kesha in 2011 at Oxygen. I was backstage and she ran up to the lady who was beside me, a publicist, and by way of greeting, licked her down the side of her face.
I've never seen
anything like it. Yeah. And that is a very Kesha move. And if I was talking in one line about what this album is, it's a lick.
It's a lick from Kesha. And it's on her own label, which I suppose allows for a couple of things. First of all, it gets over all that legal issues that had, I think they were solved anyway. But also it gives her great artistic freedom. Is she using that in a way that gives us a new Kesha or an older Kesha that she's now allowed to reinvigorate?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, the constant plague for the female pop stars is the need to reinvent, but she doesn't need to reinvent here. She just needs to reset. And I think because she's been on Dr. Luke's label for the last three albums, despite the feud, she's kind of played around with form. And I think she's been saving this wild girl, like free and rambunctious energy for this record. So she's back. And I think some people were doubting, like, maybe the Kesha who licks people in the face was actually Dr. Luke's creation. I think she's really reclaiming it here and she's back to her wild ways.
Yeah, I was actually quite surprised how much of Delusional we could play without there being a problem. Don't think we'll have quite the same ease with Red Flag. There is language in the song Red Flag, as it is in practically every track on the record. It's dangerous and unforgettable. Upon emotions that are overflowing, out of control and hopeless. The crazy in me sees the crazy in you, and I think I need it. All right, I'll take it down before she heads into another potty mouth section of the song. And the word that rhymes with glitch and starts with B is all over this record. I think there's a couple of songs where she says it, you know, she starts the
straight
song
away,
with that, and she kind of, I suppose she's having a bit of fun with that.
She's really just saying hello.
She's
somewhere all the time. She's somewhere all the time between a chipmunk and Britney Spears. And for the most part, like, I have to admit, like, if you want a jolt of energy as an album, this is a great album to listen to. If you're walking down the street with this in your headphones, it'll put a little, you know, jump in your step.
And but also, you'll be totally misled by the opening, maybe 2-3 minutes of it, where it's just kind of ethereal.
She's only messing with your head for that bit.
And then whacking.
Well, that's a song called the Freedom, word. Which is, you know, which is her celebrating the end of this whole
era.
So she starts with a nice piano flourish to cleanse the palate. You know,
2:35 of soft loveliness. And then it's like a roller coaster with the B.
Okay, stars from you on this one, Kane. Overall, and stars.
I really love that she is back on form. So much craziness on here. I want to shout out "Joyride," the lead single, which sounds like if a Moldovan Eurovision entry in the best way. This is 4 stars.
4 stars, and some great collaborators on here as well. Father John Misty is one that springs to mind. There are others on there as well.
Jonathan Wilson, the producer.
And Madison Love, isn't it, as well, is on there too. Stars.
Yippee-ki-yay is another great track, so I'm going to say Yippee-ki-yay, 4 stars.
Yeah, I loved Yippee-ki-yay. It was kind of a country song. 4 stars. Pretty solid for Kesha and the album, period. We'll be back in a moment with Lord and Virgin. All right, let us move on then to Lord and Virgin. Just remind us who we're talking about when we talk about Lord and what part of Lord we're getting in this album, Nadine.
Well, Lord is Ella O'Connor, a New Zealander, 28 years old, and she is back with the new album, Virgin. And I suppose everybody would immediately, when you think of Lord, if you're a fan, you'll think of that track Royals, which came out in 2013 when she was just a teenager. And it was such a good song. It was her debut single, you know, and it was absolutely immense. But over the years, she's now at around 28, and she's gone through a few ups and downs. She's had albums that weren't quite as well received. Her last album, Solar Power, kind of divided critics, and she's also somebody who really grapples with her own she talks a lot very, very honestly and very openly about weight, gender, dating, a lot of different issues. So she's a very interesting artist.
Let's have a listen to a track called Favourite Daughter. Favourite Daughter, the title of that track from Lord and the new album Virgin. The album cover itself, there's a picture, it's like an x-ray of a pelvis, and then there's an IUD device kind of superimposed on top of that. And when you listen to the lyrics closely within the album, there's a real physicality and a viscerality to what she's singing about, Cian.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, that's the metaphor for how much she's bearing her soul, how much she's bearing her truth. You're getting under the skin on this. And there's also, I guess, a sexual nature to some of the songs as well. Like, she finds herself going through a breakup in New York City, and she's, you know, she's amorous at times. She's questioning whether she's just like, is it love or ovulation that's sending her this way? She's questioning her relationship to sex and validation in the same way. You know, she's grieving her relationship, and she's comforting herself by sort of representing her own self-love as this perfect boyfriend. She's questioning her gender. There's tectonic shifts going on, and I think, you know, there's some real searingly honest moments, and I think that's kind of why she represented as an x-ray.
Were you saying, Nadine, that you feel that there's a search on here for some kind of a musical collaborator for Lord that might bring her out of herself, if that's the right term to use?
Well, I mean, she's jettisoned Jack Antonoff, who's worked with Taylor Swift. She used to work with him a lot in favour of Jimmy Stack on this record, and he's worked with Bon Iver, and Justin Vernon of Bon Iver does actually, I think, contribute some guitar to this album as well. But to be honest, for me, this record is most interesting for its lyrics and for her explorations of self. Musically, I found it a little backgroundy, a little anodyne, and I'm really disappointed to say that because I think she is an important artist, and I think that she commands so much influence and has such intensity and such vulnerability, and I think that her presence on the pop landscape is very significant and important. But musically, as the sonic landscape sort of continued from track to track, I didn't find myself in love with the music. I love a little bit of like a sonic flourish, a little change, a little movement, and I wasn't getting that a lot of the time here.
I've just listened to a bit of a minute of a Lord Man of the Year. Just wanted a little flavour there of Man of the Year from Lord and Virgin. A real sparse sound to that particular track. Did it work overall for you, Cian?
I did, yeah. I know it's scant in the production, but she did say, she said she wanted load-bearing pillars only. She didn't want any flourish. She just wanted the lyrics to talk for herself. And she gets in there. Broken Glass is a gorgeous song. Well, heartbreaking song about her eating disorder, which I found very moving. Clear Blue is all about her taking a pregnancy test and those moments afterwards. I got very swept up in it and I really enjoyed it. That's 4 stars.
4 from you. What do you say? I don't think you were in quite that place, were you, Nadine?
Like, I feel like it could be a grower, and if it is a grower, it'll be a 3.5. And if I don't continue to listen as much as I'd like, it'll be like a 3. I'm sort of in between at the moment. I'm hovering because she's one of those artists, you know, this could, you know, grow with time.
3.25, somewhere in there.
That's it.
3.25. Okay.
Thank you very much to Nadine O'Regan and Cian Sullivan. Kay Tempest's self-titled Kesha Period and Lord Virgin were the 3 albums that they were speaking to us about this evening. And that is our lot for this Friday and indeed for this week here on Arena. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.